Spy in the Sky interview. Following the spiral of the question mark. Welcome along to Fire in the Sky interviews. Max Ashley here, and it is a pleasure to have you with me once again. I'm going to be interviewing someone who I have interviewed several times before. This man is no stranger to Fire in the Sky, and that is Ola Damagard. The interview has taken some time to put together due to bad internet connections, being the most trivial, right up to the more sublime of data disappearing before one's eyes. But we did keep going, we persevered, and finally we got our interview on a hard drive, and that is the interview which will be coming up. Ola has researched many different false flag events. He started doing deep research into this theme after the assassination of Olive Palmer in 1986, and that was my very first interview with Ola. Since then, I have interviewed him in regards to the Kennedy assassination and the involvement of Operation 40, the Norway attacks and Andreas Breivik, the Paris attacks, as well as the Nice attacks, and the hidden signs in false flag events. And I shouldn't forget Laurel Canyon, which is also very important to the way things have played out since the 70s. It would be Laurel Canyon and the music industry. If you'd like more information in regards to Ola Damagard, then go to lightonconspiracies.com and you'll find a lot of information there. And most of it you can download as well. And make sure you get a PDF copy of his book, Coup d'etat in Slow Motion. Ola Damagard, welcome along to Fire in the Sky.
Thank you so much.
Third time lucky, shall we say?
I mean, we recorded this the other day, like 2.5 hours, and then boom, suddenly all the sound files, everything was just deleted from the computer. So let's hope that we're more lucky this one.
Yeah,
this time.
Yeah, and maybe the listeners, maybe they don't realize the amounts of frustration we go through and repetition that we are forced to do. When we're doing interviews that, like you said, quite obviously hit a nerve in some areas that end up people start. How would you explain it? They start roaming into other people's computers.
Yeah, the thing is that since I've done like hundreds of interviews, there's a very clear pattern. Some, when I speak on with Skype with normal people, sometimes it breaks up, sometimes there's a problem. But this is so different because here it can be like in one topic and I start mentioning a certain name, boom, it just shuts down. Mm-hmm. We go get back up online. As soon as I mention the same name, boom, it goes down. Like when that happens, like repeatedly, you sort of get the image or the idea of what's going on.
Yeah.
But the thing is, we're stubborn. I'm not giving up. So it's just a matter of, okay, fine, then I'll repeat it once more.
Yeah, and the story comes out clearer.
Yeah. So part of the game, and whoever, if anyone is sabotaging it, I would say, get a like. And realize that you're sabotaging for yourself, because we're trying to save humanity by exposing these things, you know. So, and the people who are blocking these type of things or think that they're doing the right thing just because they're well paid, please understand that this concerns the future of your children, the future of yourself, and so on as well. And just because you think that because you've been given a title and good pay and then sitting in some dark office somewhere surrounded by a computer, that does not mean that the people, the elite few, gives a damn about you. They're just using you to do these things. And the second they don't need you anymore, you're out. So it doesn't matter if you're a high up military guy or in surveillance or whatever it is. When they don't need you anymore, there's no loyalty whatsoever on their part, and you will be out. Join the rest of us. So why not do yourself a favor and the rest of us, leave us alone and let's do what is needed to lift this world to the next beautiful level.
Mm-hmm. Beautifully said, Ola, beautifully said. So, getting back to the theme at hand, the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King.
The reason why I've spent so much time, I and other researchers, on some of these major assassinations like JFK, Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, Robert Kennedy, and so on, is because the people that took them out did it for a reason. They were taken out at a very specific time in history when they were about to make a major change for the better in the world. And they tried to discredit them, they tried to destroy their reputation, everything up until that point. But it came to a point where the only way to get rid of this threat, as the way they saw it, was to kill them. And the people and the power structure that took these beautiful people out are still in place, still affecting our lives on a daily basis with all kinds of crap, including chemtrails and false flag operations and state-sponsored terrorism and so on. So this is the reason why we need to look into these old, so-called old assassinations, expose what happened so that we can track down who is still active and then transcend this whole problem. So to go to Martin Luther King, who is one of the few people that I really admire, him and Mahatma Gandhi were two beautiful souls that devoted themselves for the principle of nonviolence, fearlessness, and compassion for humanity. And it was this compassion for the truth and for love that got them killed in the end. Both of them met a very violent end. And so if we go back and look a little on who was this Martin Luther King, most people know him from I've Had a Dream, I Had a Dream, that speech, and I've Been on the Mountaintop, these type of things. But he was so, so much more than that. He was a reverend, a preacher, from the south of the U.S. He was black, and he was working very hard from an early age on trying to erase the borders between the races, between black and white, equal rights, and so on. But over the years, especially after he received the Nobel Peace Prize in 64, he was seen more and more as a major threat to the establishment by people like J. Edgar Hoover, who was the head of the FBI, who hated him, who absolutely despised and hated Dr. King. But you also have to see that this was in the mid-60s, where the states were in a... There was a lot of riots going on, a lot of, freedom. There were a lot of demonstrations against the Vietnam War. There was so much going on, and at times the U.S. was very near a new civil war. So big changes, big changes. But not only did he fight for the civil rights and the integration between the races, in 67 he also took a very strong stand against the Vietnam War. And the Vietnam War was a major, major income for the military-industrial complex, as well as the mob, with all the drugs being brought in and out with the help of this awful war. And then, if that was not enough, then he started widening sort of the front against the elite by starting what he called the Poor People's Campaign, where he included everybody poor, meaning not only blacks but also poor white people or poor Latin Americans or Chinese, Asian, everyone, Native Americans, everybody was included in this thing. And the idea was to arrange for what he called the Poor People's Campaign by walking or getting to Washington and get somewhere between 30,000 and a million people to camp outside the government building. Just camp out there, block the whole thing until they made a change. And this campaign was planned to shut down the nation's capital in the spring of 1968. And this is exactly the time when he was taken out.
Up until that point, with what we know from cultural Marxism now, he would have unwittingly played into their hand as a tool of divide and rule. But with the poverty march, that's where he would be going against their agenda and actually uniting everyone.
This is what they feared. They rule with very few methods, one of them, divide and conquer. And here was someone who totally wanted to unite instead, making it absolutely horrific for the elite few who had been using the rest of us as slaves for so many, many decades. So that was the time. And the reason why they focused on Martin Luther King was because he was in the center of this whole thing. There were so many more movements going on and other organizations, Black Panthers and so on. But he was sort of the centerpiece. And this nonviolent approach was the thing that got everyone gathered around him. So what the dark forces aimed to do was to deflate the whole move, sort of like national movement in all different areas with one hit. And this is almost exactly what they managed to do as well. And not only that, just some 60 days later, boom, they took out Robert Kennedy as well, who was the second threat against them. And there's a lot of signs that could show a possibility that had Robert Kennedy been elected the next president of the USA, that he would have chosen Martin Luther King as vice president.
Wow.
And my God, would the world look different than it does now?
Yeah. Robert Kennedy, he was campaigning quite heavily against the mafia, wasn't he?
Yeah, during JFK's, the year under his brother JFK. But this guy was he was standing for the same ideas and more or less the same principles as Martin Luther King. That I tell you, had these people lived, the world we know now with 9/11, the war on terror, all these wars in Syria, Libya, Afghanistan, Iraq would never ever have occurred. The war, you know, this whole international mass deception of false flag terrorism, none of that would exist. None of it. Instead, we would have had, I believe, a world that would be so much more united and liberated.
Mm-hmm.
So these assassinations, very, very important to look into, so that we can stop these things, horrible things, from happening again.
Yeah. Yes, and 60 days isn't that isn't very very much time in between two major assassinations either.
No, they out of the three biggest ones, JFK, Martin Luther King, and Robert Kennedy, these two were, they were at a point where people were suddenly starting to feel optimism again, to gather strength, because they were totally knocked out with the JFK assassination. Then Malcolm X happened, but that was more towards the black population where that sort of knocked them out. But then in 68, there was this new feeling of like, yes, we can make a change. We can make it. We can do it. And like Robert Kennedy was being treated like a rock star almost. So the whole thing was on moving forward in a way like an avalanche. And then, boom, boom, these two assassinations happen and everything just died. And it hasn't really gotten back to where it was until more or less now, if even now, I think.
Yeah, I'd say even now it's difficult to unite people.
Yeah, for sure. But difficult, not impossible. So, I would like to say that a lot of the things we're talking about today is thanks to Dr. William Pepper, who was the attorney for James Earl Ray, the alleged assassin of Martin Luther King. He has always been the attorney of Sirhan Sirhan, the alleged assassin of Robert Kennedy. And without his incredible work over some 39 years, much many of the things we're talking about today would not be available to us at all. And he's written a book called Orders to Kill, about the assassination of Martin Luther King. Unfortunately, I haven't read it, but I've followed a lot, followed his career a lot, and many interviews and so on, and it's absolutely astounding what he has brought forward, very fearlessly, and incredible job as a lawyer.
Okay.
So, if I just also want to mention that there was actually a legal court case in December 1999 where the case against James Earl Ray, the alleged assassin, was tried in a court of law in Memphis. There were some 70 witnesses testifying. There was more than 4,000 pages of transcript from this trial. And it only took the jury some 59 minutes to come back with their decision to exonerate James Earl Ray, totally clearing him of all guilt in this thing. And the whole thing was settled with $100 because the King family was accused of doing this trial because of money, because they wanted money, but that was not the case. But they tried, it was a civil law case where they tried a man called Lloyd Jowers, who we're going to come back to. And like I said, so James Earl Ray was totally cleared in a legal court. And so it's not even interesting to look into, was he guilty or was he not? He was not. And that's it. So I would like today to focus on what actually happened instead. Instead of the official story, look at what evidence has come forward since then.
Okay.
So, also, when you look at world history, it is important to see, you know, to put things in perspective and see what was actually going on when this person was murdered, because it always happens at a time, a very critical point, boom. Had they lived, they would have done something major. And here was, he was killed on the 4th of April. Robert Kennedy was killed on the 5th of June, so very close. And at the time, King was doing a tour in the U.S. He had been in Los Angeles, and he was moving across the country on his way to Miami, where it seems like the assassination had been planned to be carried out. Because when you look at the forces that we're going to expose today, I believe that just like with the JFK assassination, there were multiple options, which there always is. Should one place not work, then they would hit him in another location or a third location and so on. And it seems like Los Angeles was the place where he was being targeted. You will see that James Earl Ray was there at the same time, not knowing why he was there. He was being controlled by a CIA handler, but he was there so that he could be the patsy and take the fall for it in Los Angeles, had it happened there. He then followed Martin Luther King across the U.S. and on the way to Memphis, where the assassination was aimed to take place. But then Dr. King decided to make a detour to Memphis, Tennessee, and at the same time, James Earl Ray was also ordered to go to Memphis, Tennessee at the same time. You will also see that there's a team of snipers that we're going to mention later on. They were also in Los Angeles at the same time. So the whole plot was being moved surrounding Dr. King wherever he was going at this time.
Do you think that team or that group of people then sort of moved on to Robert Kennedy?
No, this is the thing. The reason why King was not killed in Los Angeles, I would say, is that the plans to take out Robert Kennedy were activated long before then. And two assassinations with only less than 2 months apart in the same city with a similar setup, that would have just been too obvious. Okay. So that is why they canceled the Los Angeles plans, in my opinion. And then they aimed for Miami instead, because Miami was the stronghold, is the stronghold of the CIA, where Operation J.M. Wade and also Operation Mongoose was very strong, with Operation 40, with the ultra secret hit team and so on, all based in Miami. So that would have been the perfect place to take him out. But it seems like they also aimed at possibly taking him out in Chicago, because just a month or so before the assassination, there was a secret meeting in the upper state of New York where mafia boss Sam Giancana from Chicago, together with his middleman Johnny Rosselli, both of them very involved in the JFK assassination, they met up with people from the FBI and the CIA. I believe one of the people from the CIA was E. Howard Hunt, also deeply involved in the JFK assassination and the Watergate burglary. And Sam Giancana was then offered $1 million for the contract to kill King, but he turned it down. And it seems like instead this contract was then offered to the mob boss in New Orleans, Carlos Marcello, also very, very central in the assassination of JFK and Robert Kennedy, hated them both. And it seemed like it was Carlos Marcello who then accepted this this contract and then gave the task to one of his people in Memphis, okay, called Frank Liberto. To kill a man like this in a major assassination, it takes time, a lot of preparations. And one of the things that they need in this operation is a patsy, someone that can take the fall, that have a history, that will work in media, and will look criminal, will look weird, and so on. And like I mentioned before, the head of FBI, J. Edgar Hoover, hated Martin Luther King. And he and one of the oil barons from Texas, also very involved in the JFK assassination, you will see the same people, the same team, just having like a reunion from the JFK assassination and around Martin Luther King. The same players appear again. And so when you do these hits, one of the main thing is that you need a patsy, someone that really can work in media, look guilty, look weird, look violent, and to... so that the population will have an easy time accepting that he was the one who carried it out.
And three names is also important too.
Yeah, they always have three names: Muslim terrorists and assassins and serial killers. I've been told that is to add to the credibility. And here we have James Earl Ray, Lee Harvey Oswald, these type of names. And because the thing is, he was just called Jimmy, so he was never called James Earl or anything, but in the official story, it's always James Earl Ray. But there was a series of meetings between the richest man in the U.S. at the time, H.L. Hunt, together with J. Edgar Hoover, the chief of the FBI. They met in hotel rooms all over the U.S. and were talking about this thing, and Hunt thought that he could get rid of, to crush King's reputation via his radio programs, but Hoover insisted this man needs to die. That's the only way we can stop him. So it seems like this plan was in motion quite early, because in December 66, it seems like they handpicked James Earl Ray, who at that point was in the Missouri State Prison, that he would be the perfect patsy. He had a background. He was not very clever. All of his family members had been in prison, including his dad. And he had also worked earlier for the OSS and for a very short period of time, as far as I know, for the CIA. So they knew about him, and they had their eyes on him. I also believe that there was some mind control things done on it, him. You can see there's especially one photo where one of these lineup photos from the front and from the side, and in one of these photos, you can see he's got a big, big scar where they've shaved off the hair and done some operation to the skull, which match exactly the location where they put implants and so on. So
okay.
I don't know. This is pure speculation. But many prisoners at that time in Missouri and nearby prisons were telling stories about this. And my friend Chip Tatum, the CIA whistleblower, who he used to be a Night Stalker pilot, these black helicopters, he said that during his career, he flew in several people to Springfield, the prison in Springfield, I believe, in Missouri, where who he called the famous doctors did all kinds of experiments on these poor people. And Chip's job was just to fly them in, whatever happened to them there, he don't know, but then fly them out, and then maybe these individuals were used for different operations and so on. He had no idea.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems like many of these experiments has been carried out and is being carried out in prisons or institutions.
Yeah.
So in December 66, they picked him, this guy. And then $25,000 was given by J. Edgar Hoover to the second in charge of the FBI, Clyde Tolson, who was also J. Edgar Hoover's alleged lover. And he then went to the local godfather in Memphis. His name was Russell Atkins. He was the head of the Dixie Mafia. This was not a high-profile godfather, not at all. But the Dixie Mafia was quite powerful at the time, working under the mafia in New Orleans and Carlo Marcello. The godfather, Russell Atkins, he was more like what he was described as a fixer. He was employed by the city, you know, very discreet, very, you wouldn't notice him at all. But he was the guy that got things carried out. He had his own assassin living next to him. He built a house for him. Chess Butler was his name. So he could just use him anytime he wanted to get rid of someone. It was just get hold of Chess and sort it out.
Really?
But anyway, the money, $25,000, was then delivered by Tolson, Clyde Tolson, to Russell Atkins. And he then went to the prison warden and delivered the money, arranging for an escape from this prison. And this escape took place on April 23rd, 1967. That is more or less 1 year exactly before the assassination of King. So he was, James Earl Ray was smuggled out in a bread truck and picked up by his brother, then somehow got to Canada. And in Montreal, he was approached by a man called Raoul, who started guiding his movements and giving him money for different tasks. One of the things was he was being told to go to Canada and transport things into the U.S. or go down to Mexico and bring things across the border, these type of things. He was also informed to go and buy a Mustang 1966, a white. The one he bought was pale yellow, but the order was to get a white one. You will see why later on. But anyway, during the month upcoming to the assassination, this mysterious Raoul will keep appearing in the stories told by James Earl Ray. I personally believe that this Raoul is a composite of 3 to 4 different individuals, all with the first name Raoul. Very strange, and I think that James Earl Ray, to not put himself in a more dangerous situation than he already was in, put them into one fictitious individual that he's just giving all these.
So he made a composite from the four.
Yeah, I believe so. So James Earl Ray was out there being prepared as a patsy, being controlled by Raoul 1, 2, or 3, whatever, this Raoul character. At the same time, there was a series of meetings to prepare for this assassination. About 3 weeks before the killing, J. Edgar Hoover held a series of meetings with persons involved in the CIA and military intelligence in the Phoenix operation in Southeast Asia. And Operation Phoenix was a mass extinction program, a mass murder program in Vietnam, where they killed thousands and thousands of Vietnamese people. And the head of that operation was Ted Shackley, who, if you remember our interview about Operation 40, he was one of the key people in Operation 40, this ultra-secret hit team of assassins, together with David Attlee Phillips and E. Howard Hunt. E. Howard Hunt, who appears here again. There's also General Edward Lansdale, very central in the JFK assassination. I believe he was involved in these meetings as well. But also, a series of meetings were taking place in Memphis. Memphis was one of the possible options. This place was being prepared. And if you remember, Carlos Marcello gave the task to a businessman in Memphis called Frank Liberto. He then brought money and approached a man called Lloyd Jowers. Lloyd Jowers was a former Memphis police officer who had quit the task force and opened a restaurant called Jim's Grill. Jim's Grill was very close to the Lorraine Motel where the hit was done later. And in his restaurant, there was a series of meetings. At these meetings, he had invited former colleagues from the Memphis Police Department, one of them being Lieutenant Earl Clark, who was later the spotter. We're going to come back to him. John Barger, he was a former partner. And another police officer called Frank Strausser. He is one of the shooters that killed Martin Luther King. There were also two men that Jarvis didn't know but were federal agents. I believe one of them, E. Howard Hunt. And Raoul was also present at one of these meetings, bringing the rifle for Jarvis to hold. At these meetings, there was also an additional person, a black undercover police department officer called Merrill McCullough. He was later the first black full-feathered CIA employee for many, many years. And he is the guy who, when you see the famous photos of King lying bleeding on the balcony, he's the one kneeling next to King, being the first to approach the body, checking him for life signs. So this man, undercover Memphis police department officer, CIA employee, he was also paid by military intelligence at the time. He was at these meetings and then the first person to approach the body. I believe he was there to check King for signs of life. And if he was still alive, maybe finish him off with a syringe or something like that, but make sure that he was actually hit, fatally hit. Anyway, so what we will see is that upcoming to this assassination, the whole security thing is being pulled away from him. And 48 hours before the killing, all video and audio surveillance was called off by J. Edgar Hoover personally. He had kept Martin Luther King under heavy 24/7 surveillance from 1959 up until the day he was murdered, and then just 48 hours
before, so long,
everything is shut down.
Wow.
But we were talking about Memphis, Miami, so why did he end up in Memphis? And the reason was there was a sanitary worker strike in Memphis that broke out where two local black workers were killed in one of these garbage trucks. And the white staff was given the day off, the black people not. And that was just too much for these poor workers. So they started this protest march, walking around with signs saying, "I am a man," just saying, "We demand to be treated like human beings and not like cattle," and so on. And when King saw that and heard about this, he decided to make a detour to Memphis to support these people. He was there once, And at one of these rallies, just when he was about to finish, there was a little note slipped to him saying, please come back or promise us you'll come back to Memphis. So when he saw that note, he said, I'll promise I'll be back. I believe that that note was given to him by one of the people in his inner circle that were part of the assassination. They just wanted to make sure that he would come back.
Okay.
Because Memphis was the perfect place to hit, because one of J. Edgar Hoover's close associates for many years, his name was Frank Holloman, at that specific time, he was in charge both of the fire station and the police department in Memphis. So just one person could control both places. Also, the mob were there, the stronghold were there, so they could control all different areas that was needed in a plan like this. So the King Party was about to book a room at the Holiday Inn Hotel. But when Hoover heard about this, he went out in national media and started ridiculing King, saying that here is this black leader saying you should boycott businesses with white owners and only go for businesses that were owned by black people. And here he is booking into a hotel, a white hotel, just because he likes luxury and so on. So indirectly, he forced the King Party to change their plan and then book a room at the Lorraine Motel, which was the only black-owned hotel in Memphis. Now, this was a famous hotel. I'm not sure if it was the absolute only one owned by black owners, but it was a famous, nice hotel where many stars of the time, like Nat King Cole, Aretha Franklin, Otis Redding. I know the song In the Midnight Hour was actually composed at the Lorraine Motel. And stuff.
Okay.
That was, B.B. King used to stay there as well. So that was sort of the natural choice to do if you did not book into the Holiday Inn. And so on. So they managed to get him to book into the Lorraine Motel. There was only one slight problem. The first booking was for room 202, which was on the ground floor, in to the left and in sort of like in a corner of the parking area, where the driver could just reverse the car up more or less to the door. King could get out, and with just a few steps, he would be inside the building. This was absolutely not what would work for a hit team. So instead, an order was given to get him up on the second floor. And also because this hotel has all the staircases on the outside and with balcony. So it was a perfect place. Could they get him up on the second floor, then he would have to walk out and be out in the open, totally vulnerable for an ambush. So somebody that we're going to come back to managed to get the booking changed to room 306, right in the center of the building, on the second floor with a balcony. So a perfect place for a hit, an absolute horrible place when it came to security. And the owners protested against this, but the person from the King Party insisted, and so it was changed.
Yeah, and I'm sure you're going to enlighten us who that person was.
Well, we can do that now. The son of the Dixie Mafia's godfather, his name was Ron Atkins. He was 16 at the time. He overheard a phone call from Frank Holloman, the chief of the police and fire department, calling the wife of Russell Atkins, the godfather, saying,
mm-hmm.
We need to get King up on the second floor on the balcony. See to it. Get hold of O.C. Evers, which was a paid informer that worked tightly together with the Dixie Mafia. Get him to sort it out. So Russell Atkins' wife called O.C. Evers and told him to get hold of Jesse Jackson to go to the motel and change the room. So Jesse Jackson, according to this witness, contacted Loree Bailey, the wife of the owner, and managed to get this change made. And right after the shots were fired, when Loree Bailey came out and saw King lying there, she just screamed, "Oh my God, what have I done? What have I not done?" She then went to her room, had a stroke or a heart attack, depending on who you listen to, and was brought to the same hospital where King died, and she then died 5 days later.
Oh, really?
I would very much put a question mark around that death and put the question out there, was she silenced because she was the one who knew, who contacted the motel and changed the room?
Yeah.
We're going to come back to this hospital as well. So in the inner circle around King, just like with Julius Caesar, he was surrounded by traitors, informers, police informers. His driver was paid by the the FBI, his photographer, and also, according to the son of the Dixie Mafia, he saw paper bags with payments that were being delivered by the FBI to the mob to be handed out to these different people that were doing jobs for them. And he, the son, remembers the name of three of these bags, and one of them were O.C. Evers. That was the man we just talked about who got hold of Jesse Jackson to do this thing.
Mm-hmm.
A second one was Jesse Jackson. And the third one was a local pastor called Reverend Samuel Billy Kyles. We're going to have a close look at Samuel Billy Kyles and Jesse Jackson when it comes to the actual assassination.
Great. Most people would be aware of the name of Jesse Jackson, but the Reverend Kyles, I don't think many people are aware of him.
No, but I'm going to come with some very serious accusations, and I invite Jesse Jackson to come on this program, as I've done in many other programs, saying, please, if you do not agree with these accusations, please step forward and make comments. But up until now, absolute silence.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so the day before the assassination, all the black staff at the fire station and the police station were pulled away from their jobs the day before and on the day of the assassination. They were, given different locations. They were ordered to go to other fire stations. Never happened before, but to get them out of the way. Also, normally when King arrived to Memphis, there were a group of black police officers that always voluntarily were his bodyguards, and they were, you know, two and two outside his room. They were escorting him everywhere, but this time they were called off. They were told, no, don't worry, security has been taken care of, just like with JFK in Dallas, but there was no one else doing it. Also, normally, since this was in a very intense time, and King was on this constant death threat, you know, he had his house bombed. He was stabbed once, almost killed. He was shot at. He was beaten up. You know, this was daily life to him with these threats. So normally there were police cars circling the block where he was staying at all times. But the day when he was killed, these police teams, squad cars, were pulled away five blocks away from the Lorraine Motel. And when the police chief was later asked who gave the order to pull these cars away, he immediately answered, Reverend Samuel Billy Kyles. So
what?
Here is Samuel Billy Kyles involved in getting rid of the security.
Mm-hmm.
So the night before his assassination, this is when he gave this famous speech, "I've been to the mountaintop." And in that speech, he makes very clear, I think he knew that he was pushing it, you know, that his time was limited. And in the speech, he makes very clear that his best friend is Reverend Ralph Abernathy, who would then be the natural successor should anything happen to King, not Jesse Jackson at all, because Jesse Jackson, and he was like a young upcoming guy who was who King really liked to start with, but the weeks before the assassination, the relationship had been quite cold, and just a few days before he was killed, King just left the meeting very upset. He was so angry with Jesse Jackson, he just said, "Get him out of my sight," and so on. And you will also see that he's very cold towards Jesse Jackson the last few days. So I believe when you're going to see more about Jesse Jackson's behavior, I believe that Jesse was getting more and more afraid of being exposed as an informer and infiltrator, and that he was sort of also pushing time-wise for this thing to be carried out soon before he would be, before his cover was going to be blown.
Yeah.
Anyway, so yeah. In that speech as well, King says that I've been to the mountaintop, the promised land. I don't think I would get there together with you, but, and he also says longevity has its is wonderful with a long life, but I fear no one. And I'm doing God's work, and that's about it. So he turns around. It was at the Mason Temple in Memphis, and they go back to the Lorraine Motel. Then the whole next day,
which sort of does, it also has a bit of a Masonic connection with the name of the Lorraine Hotel.
No, I don't think so. It's the owner Walter Bailey. He renamed the motel after a very famous song called "Sweet Lorraine,"
I used to always think of the Lorraine Cross when I heard the name of the motel.
I don't think so. I also thought that the Mason Temple in Memphis that had a Freemasonry connection. You know, that would have been sort of the height of arrogance. But it was not. It was the Mason was a black preacher, and it was his temple. So it had nothing, as far as I know, to do with Freemasonry.
Okay.
That was the last night. Then on the day when he was killed, the last day, King spent most of his time with Dr. Ralph Abernathy in the room, and his friend, Reverend Andrew Young, who was also in this close group, he went to the district court, trying to get permission from the judge to organize this peaceful march that was scheduled for April 8th. This was April the 4th. But at this time, like I said, all security had been withdrawn. Also, there was a waitress that worked at Jim's Grill, very close by, and she was ordered not to deliver any food to the second floor of the Lorraine Motel. I believe that when we're going to look at the hit itself, the assassination itself, there are multiple shooters positioned out. These groups of snipers and so on were being controlled over radio or via radio. And they needed a specific time for the target to appear. And this was a barbecue arranged in the home of Samuel Billy Kyles, Reverend Samuel Billy Kyles. And it was scheduled for 5 o'clock. The official story now says 6 o'clock, but I believe that the first time was 5 o'clock. That was when King was supposed to be killed. So here we have Samuel Billy Kyles again. Not only did he pull away the security, it is also in his home where this barbecue is going to take place. The waitress is told not to bring any food to make sure the king would be hungry and would come to this barbecue. Also, he's also said to have been quite infamous for being a little late, King. And I think this is one thing that messes this whole plan up.
Okay.
So Samuel Billy Kyles made a whole career after the assassination telling the story how he spent the last hour of Dr. King's life together with him and Dr. Ralph Abernathy in the motel room, having a great time talking about preacher stuff and so on. Absolutely not true, according to Abernathy. He was not there at all. But this guy, Samuel Billy Kyles, got carried away a lot and said very, very telling and very odd things over the years, which we're going to talk about now. One of the things that these sniper teams that were coming to Memphis, they were following King from Los Angeles across the country, and were now, it was an Alpha 184 unit with two groups, and they were being spread out on different buildings surrounding the Lorraine Motel. I believe there was one at the penthouse at the Getty building. If we look from the balcony where King was killed, if you go right, there's a where everyone is pointing towards in this famous photo. That is the penthouse at the Getty building they're pointing at.
Okay.
Then I believe there was a second team of shooters, Lieutenant Earl Clark and Frank Strausser, in the bushes underneath on the backside of the rooming house where James Earl Ray had been ordered to book a room.
Mm-hmm.
The shots were not fired from the bathroom, which is the official story, because there was a massive big tree right in front of that bathroom. And this was not a bathroom that belonged just to the room of James Earl Ray. It was a bathroom for everyone on the floor. That tree was cut down during the night after the assassination, and all the bushes, the bushy area, was cleared away during the night by the park department on the order of the police department in Memphis, helping, as they said, the investigation. But what they did was they totally destroyed it. So anyway, I believe there was a shooter in the room where James Earl Ray had rented. We're going to come back to him. His name was Butch Campbell. Then you had, like I said, Frank Strausser, the shooter in the bushes with Lieutenant Earl Clark as the spotter. Then if you go to the fire station, there was one sniper team inside the dormitory connected with the cafeteria connected to the dormitory on the second floor in the fire station. And then a final fourth team on top of the central station building, which is to the left. It's quite a high building, but it's like 200, 300 yards away. Perfect angle. And all of these four places are a perfect ambush for the spot where King was killed.
Another triangulation.
Yeah, it's more than triangular since there were four teams, but yeah, exactly. With these assassinations, the main thing is that the target cannot survive. Whatever happens, he needs to die. And that is why they don't trust just one option. They always go for multiple options. So about half an hour before the assassination, there were a group called the Invaders, who was staying on the second floor in room 316 and 317. The Invaders was a group like a type of Black Panther group, but not violent, but they were armed, and they were helping King arranging for this march. There was a slight problem, though, because since they were armed, once the shooting started, there was the chance of them coming running out with their guns blazing, you know, maybe even hitting the sniper and so on. And you can imagine what type of scandal that could cause. So a woman, one of the employees, was sent to the room where the Invaders were and said, I'm very sorry, but you have to leave immediately. And they were like, but why? The room's been paid for, and why? There's no reason. And he said, no, I insist you need to leave immediately. And then the question was asked, on whose order? And she said, Jesse Jackson.
Ooh, again.
Here we have Jesse Jackson again in a very critical position, getting rid of a problem. Then, if you remember Frank Liberto, the one who was given the task to organize the hit, he had a grocery company and vegetable and grocery. And there was a man called John McFerrin who was there shopping, and he overheard Frank Liberto getting a phone call. That was around half an hour before the assassination, just a few minutes after the invaders were leaving their rooms and on their way. And what the witness heard was that Frank Liberto said, "Just get this son of a bitch up on the balcony and shoot him." Then a few minutes later, the same person called back, and Liberto repeated, "Just shoot the son of a bitch on the balcony." And then he added, "Then go to New Orleans and get the money from my brother." Okay. So that is about 20-6, 25-6 or something like that, when the final call, that second call, is made. So who then comes to the king room and gets him out on the balcony? It is Reverend Samuel Billy Kiles, because he was observed, because the fire station was being used for total surveillance of the motel. It was packed with people from police departments, people in suits, you know, all from all kinds of agencies and so on, where nobody knew who was actually there. And there were people that kept notes on who was coming, going, and so on. And you can see in the notes there that Billy Kiles was not at all in the room together with King for the last hour, but he came about 22 or 10 to 6, came up, knocked on the door, and then left right away. The Samuel Billy Kiles, who very recently died, not a brave person, not a brave person. Very gentle, smiling, whoa, and so on, but not a brave person at all. So I believe the phone call, it's very possible that it was Kiles that spoke to Frank Liberto, and he just said, "Get him out on the balcony," and then possibly it was Frank Holloman, the chief of police, who spoke to Frank Liberto and then contacted Kiles and said, "Get him out on the balcony, get him out." When you hear the story of Samuel Billy Kiles, I'm going to add a link here so people can hear him tell the story again and again and again. I just made this compilation of video clips where you can hear him tell the story himself. And he tells the story that he went into the room with King, and they had a great time. And then he helped him pick out a tie. It was an orange and black tie, put it on him, and so on. But when you hear what the members of the SWAT teams, of the sniper teams, have revealed to William Pepper, they said that in their orders, they were told, do not fire at targets without a tie, meaning only targets with ties. So the ties are extremely important in this operation. And so here we have, once again, Samuel Billy Kiles saying that he picked out and put on a tie on Dr. King. Then when King went out on the balcony, the reason why he was standing still for maybe half a minute or so was that he was talking to the people at the parking down below. And the one he was speaking to or talking to was Jesse Jackson. And the topic was, "Jesse, come on, put on a tie. We're going to a barbecue, dress up." And then Jesse Jackson said, they made sort of like a joke of it when they talk about these things. And Jesse Jackson said, "Well, the only thing I need is a good appetite. I don't need a tie."
Wow, that's really quite amazing.
It is, because that is the thing that keeps him standing still, and that was more or less the last word that he uttered. It was like the very last words were, his driver, I believe, said, "It's a bit chilly, maybe you should have an overcoat." So King turns around and said, "Would you mind bringing my overcoat?" And then boom, the shot is fired, and he goes down. But Samuel Billy Kiles, he kept telling the same story, that he was standing next to King on the balcony, and then he moved away And when he had moved six steps away, boom, the shot rang out. But one time, and you will see that in, or you will hear this in this video that I supplied as well, he said on TV, only as I moved away so he could have a clear shot, the shot rang out.
Mm.
Only as I moved away so he could have a clear shot, the shot rang out. Here you have a Freudian slip, major, major.
He also did his explanation with the fingers as well.
He always kept his fingers like this. And some people say this is a very Freemasonic symbol, and that also there are major claims made that he and Jesse Jackson were members in a black Freemasonry setup called the Bull Society, B-O-U-L-E. Mm-hmm. So I don't know, but he was repeating the same story again and again and again. He was not on the balcony next to King, but he was down in the parking lot, and I believe that he was moving away for sure, just like he says, so he could have a clear shot. It was just that he was not on the balcony. So then,
wow, coward.
Then, yeah. Then when you hear Billy Kaas talk about the shot, he always says kapaya, very dramatic, kapaya. But that is not the way a bullet or gunshot sounds. The normal is like one bound, but he says kapaya. And I believe that there is a possibility that King was hit with more than one bullet. This is my theory. I've never heard that before, but I truly believe that that is the case. Because also, when you look at the wounds from the autopsy, when you look at the photos from the autopsy, which do not exist, the only thing that I've been able to find are drawings from photos, you know, like medical drawings. Why did they do that? The same with the JFK thing. Why did they make very, very beautiful drawings instead of just using the photos to be able to manipulate it, I would say. And what you see in these photos, and also what the witnesses said, is that the shot hit King somewhere on the right side of the jaw and just made a massive big wound on the right side of his face. But then on the drawing from the autopsy, there's a second hole in his throat on the right-hand side. And it said that it was because he was leaning over the balcony, but the railing on the balcony. But you almost had to, like, I don't know how, in very weird angle to be able to have the bullet cause both of these wounds. I believe two shots hitting more or less in the same spot.
Okay. Wasn't he turning to get a coat?
Yeah, but that doesn't make sense at all, because the room was to his right and the shot was to his right. So if he had turned towards the room, he would have been hit on the left side.
Left-hand side,
but he was
hit
on the right-hand side. So this kapaya, I believe that you had these different teams in this perfect ambush under the radio control, and green light was given, and then fire, and everybody was shooting at the same time, meaning that he would die for sure. And so when you see, as soon as King goes down and he's lying there, somebody puts a white towel across his face. Okay. If you look at these famous photos on the balcony when King is lying there, there is a cot where, you know, with towels and beddings and so on. But this was 6 o'clock.
Yeah, like the motel cleaning wagon.
Yeah, on wheels, like a cart on wheels. But this was 6 o'clock in the evening, not the time to change beddings or towels or anything. So what was that doing there? I believe it was there to have access to towels and beddings and so on, to be able to cover up these bullet wounds so that nobody would see that there was actually more than one shot fired. My theory.
Your theory makes sense.
Otherwise, I wouldn't bring it forward. It makes perfect sense to me. The guy, then you see the guy that puts the towel on the face of King, because with a massive big gaping hole on the side of the face, what difference would that do? You know, it wouldn't help King. It's only there to cover up, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
And then Billy Kyles, back to Billy Kyles, what did he say? He went straight to get a bedspread and cover King from the neck down. Because in the story of Samuel Billy Kyles that he keeps repeating or kept repeating was that there was a second shot right, and he always put his hand right in the chest, on the chest, saying that a dum-dum bullet ripped his whole chest out. That bullet hole or that wound has never been mentioned at all, except for Samuel Billy Kyles, who then covered him with a bedspread. So within seconds, he had a towel on his face and a bedspread covering his body, so you couldn't see the wounds. This is what I think he was hit three times, one in the face, one in the neck, and one in the chest.
Yeah.
Then also back to dear Samuel Billy Kyles. He says that the thing that he thought of was to take a cigarette from King, removed a cigarette from his hand and a cigarette package from his pocket, because he thought that King, he didn't want King's kids to know that he was smoking. I mean, here you have your apparent, one of your best friends is lying, half his head blown away, half his face blown away, and the thing you care about is to get rid of some cigarettes in his pocket. Not very logical.
Strange.
I would say, I think this is clearing evidence, get evidence out of the way. And I think maybe these cigarettes were poisoned, you know, or something like that, to add to the effect of the murder, you know, and that was the reason he got.
Mm-hmm.
So you have the tie, the symbol of who to hit and who not to hit. The only two that were without ties were Jesse Jackson and Samuel Billy Kyles.
Yeah.
The ones with ties were Andrew Young, who was a target as well, but he was down in the parking area, Martin Luther King, and a doctor or Reverend Ralph Abernathy. You see, we got a clear image here.
Mm-hmm.
Jesse Jackson, Samuel Billy Kyle, both of them get rid of protection and then cover up the wounds. Then Jesse Jackson gets rid of the invaders. He's the one who changed the rooms. He refuses to wear a tie. He's the one keeping Martin Luther King in a fixed position at the balcony. And then what he does is he runs up the balcony, not the fastest way where the other people run up to check on King, but he comes from the other way where the invaders' room were. I think maybe just to make sure that there was no one left that would come out, and in that case he could stop them. Then he goes up, throws a towel on King's face, and
okay.
Then you got this tearful story that he sometimes told, that King died in his arms. At no point in time does he hold King, does he touch King's body, except for this thing with the towel, according to people who were there and so on. But what he did, according to Reverend Andy Young, he said people do very strange things when they get traumatized. He said Jesse Jackson bent down and dipped his hands in King's blood on the balcony, and then smeared it off on his shirt. That is the same shirt Ben was holding, or he wearing, the next morning.
Okay.
When he went on national TV at the Today Show. Then he disappeared. He was gone for some 20 minutes, they say, and he was walking around telling the staff, do not talk to the press, I'll do that. There's another addition to this whole thing that is even worse, was when you do carry out these assassinations, you need to be in control of all different aspects, on all different layers, levels of this thing. And some of the key positions is the ambulance, the emergency ward, and the autopsy. These are key positions, so that you are in control of life and death, and also where you can alter evidence, autopsy photos, these type of things. So did this happen here as well? And the answer is yes. Because there was a doctor called Dr. Breen Bland. He was the chief surgeon of the St. Joseph Hospital in Memphis. He was the family doctor of Russell Atkins, the Dixie Mafia's godfather. It was a Catholic operator hospital at 220 Overton Avenue. It doesn't exist anymore as far as I know, but this is a very interesting address we're going to come back to.
Okay.
Anyway, this doctor, Dr. Breen Bland, he sat in during many of these meetings before the assassination, and he said, just make sure that they take him to my hospital, and then I will make sure that he won't leave alive. So here we have them, the people behind this assassination, being in control of the hospital as well. So who told them to go to that specific hospital? Because there is another hospital called John Gaston that was normally the place to bring someone with a bullet wound or a knife wound and so on. According to himself, the one who told the ambulance driver to go to St. Joseph's was Reverend Samuel Billy Kyles. Once again, key position, key position, key position.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
So King was taken down the stairs from the balcony, put in the ambulance, and they went straight to St. Joseph's, which was not the closest hospital, but that was the one where Dr. Breen Bland was. And there was a nurse there called Lula Mae Shelby, a black lady who was working at the emergency ward. And she was there when King came. King was still alive. He did not die on the balcony. He was still alive. And so they put a catheter in his throat to help him breathe, and they were doing everything they could when Dr. Breen Bland and two men in suits arrived in the room. I believe one of these people in suits were E. Howard Hunt, but I have not been able to get that confirmed.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, what Dr. Breen Bland said was, stop working on that nigger and let him die. Everyone out.
Wow.
So everyone was shocked and was in the process of leaving the room when Lula Mae Shelby heard that these three men spat on King while he was still alive. So she turns around and she sees Dr. Breen Bland take a pillow and suffocate him. And that is how Dr. King died.
Okay. That nurse, did she appear at the court case?
No. Her son, Johnson Shelby, he made this testimony under oath. He was there when his mom came home, told this story. But they were very fearful for many, many years because a lot of people died around the King assassination, just like with the JFK and so on.
Yeah.
So it was very obvious on the stage that if you started speaking, it could end ugly.
Yeah.
We were talking about the autopsy as well, and there was a doctor called Dr. Francesco, who he made out the death certificate and so on. But I believe he refused to do an autopsy, which he said was out of respect for the King family. But I would say this is a way to avoid, pointing out the trajectory and so on.
Yeah.
But this Dr. Francesco, he later did the autopsy of Elvis as well. And then he was flown to L.A. to do it on Robert Kennedy when he was killed.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was not him who did it officially in Los Angeles on Kennedy, but he was there. And one very odd thing as well was that Milan Valverius, who was the coroner in Sweden who did the autopsy of Olof Palme, the Swedish prime minister who was gone down in 1986, and who claimed that the whole truth about this very bizarre assassination, I'll tell you, multi-layered, incredible story. He said the whole truth is in this autopsy report that was heavily censored for many, many years. Milan Valverius, according to himself, was also taking part of the autopsy of Martin Luther King.
Hmm.
How weird is that? And then years later, when he stepped forward in media in Sweden talking about this autopsy and the truth being hidden in that report, he then got his whole career destroyed and then decided to commit suicide together with his wife. So they did a double suicide on the same day.
Yeah.
Or not. I would say you can turn suicide into a verb called suicided. And that is what I believe happened to him and his wife. Yeah. So are you ready for just the final chapter here?
I certainly am.
After the assassination of the king, there was extra FBI surveillance put on Coretta King, the widow of Martin Luther King, Reverend Ralph Abernathy, and Reverend Andrew Young. Why not Jesse Jackson, and why not Reverend Samuel Billy Kyles? I think these two are yet again very incriminating facts.
Incredibly incriminating. Absolutely.
Regarding the King family, this was not the end of the misery, because just 1 year after Martin Luther King's death, his younger brother, A.D. King, was found drowned in a swimming pool. But when he was pulled out, there was no water in his lungs. How did he die? But he was following in the footsteps of Martin Luther King, and I believe that they were afraid of him taking over and doing the same thing.
Yeah.
And then in 1974, his mother, Bertha King, was shot dead in the church whilst playing the organ. I mean, really. No, there are some very, very strange things, and I'm going to come now to the final chapter of this whole thing.
Okay.
Because one thing that has always confused me is, why did they let James Earl Ray live? Because the normal template would be, especially since they failed, that was the only thing really they failed with Lee Harvey Oswald, was that he managed to get away alive from the site where he was supposed to get killed, because they want case closed right away.
Yeah.
And here, this guy, not only does he manage to escape, he goes to four different countries. He goes to Portugal, he's in Canada, he's in England, and he's on his way, I think he was in Belgium possibly, and he's on his way to Rhodesia when he's being taken and on the Heathrow Airport in England, and then brought back to the US. Then he was forced to plead guilty and sentenced to 99 years in prison, and he died there totally innocent in the 1990s. But why did they leave him alive? What was that part of the plan? And this has always confused me. But so here's the final chapter.
Mm-hmm.
There is a man called Jim Green. Now, Jim Green, he came from a small town called Caruthersville. It's I think some 50 miles north of Memphis. And he was like a thug, you know, stealing cars, dealing with bootlegging, all type of these things. And he used to work for this mysterious Raoul as well. He and his buddy, Butch Collier. And some of the things these two were doing was they once drove an 18-wheeler load of several cars from St. Louis to New Orleans to be delivered to Carlos Marcello, the mob down there, and so on. So they were like low-life criminals, but being controlled of this Raoul. They knew him as Paul, but it's the same individual as James Earl is partly referring to as Raoul. Anyway, this Jim Green has come forward, and he says that he's even written a book about it. It's called Blood and Dishonor on a Badge of Honor. He approached the King family. He met Dr. King's son, Dexter King, and so on, to tell this story and so on. And the story he told was that he was in prison at the same time as James Earl Ray, and so he knew what he looked like and so on. And before the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King, the night before, on April the 3rd, more or less at the same time as King was doing the I've Been to the Mountain speech, he said that he had a meeting in a hotel room together with Raul, where Raul offered them $5,000, actually $10,000, $5,000 before and $5,000 after, to kill James Earl Ray. The order was to kill him around 5 o'clock on April 4th. And the whole idea was that Raul would get James Earl Ray to leave the boarding room and go into Jim's Grill, which was right underneath it and right opposite the Lorraine Motel. There are two parallel streets, so it's sort of the Lorraine Motel is on the back of Jim's Grill and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And so the plan was that Raul would order James Earl Ray to rob Jim's Grill. At the same time, there would be a police officer positioned outside, and his name was John Talley. And Jim Green was ordered to get up on the roof on the other side of that parallel street with a rifle, a .357. The police officer had a .357 as well. So whoever shot James Earl Ray, it would be aimed or blamed on the gun from the police officer. So nobody would even know about this sniper on the other side.
Mm-hmm.
So here we have sniper teams on the back of the boarding house, aiming all these rifles towards the Lorraine Motel. Then a parallel street further in towards town, there is Jim Green on the roof with a sniper rifle aiming at Jim's Grill, where James Earl Ray, right after the shots have been fired, is supposed to come out, attempt a robbery, and then get killed by this police officer. Case closed, boom. King shot, James Earl Ray shot by the police. Thank God we got an efficient police force, and end of story.
Mm-hmm.
But something went wrong. And this is where I believe that it was because King had this bad habit of being late that this went sour. Because Jim Green and Butch Collier were informed they should kill James Earl Ray just after 5.
Mm-hmm.
It was said that the barbecue was at 5, but then it changed to 6 o'clock. I think it was changed because King did not come out. He was delayed. So Jim Green was up on the roof on the other side of the street waiting with a rifle for James Earl Ray to come out. And he saw him several times come out and then walk back in, come out, walk back in. And the last time he came out, he was standing walking up and down the street, but not getting close to Jim's Grill. And I think that the delay made James Earl Ray nervous, because he was not a brave man either, made him nervous. And in the end, he just got cold feet, jumped in the car, and took off.
This is the Mustang,
is it? Not coming back. In this Mustang.
Yeah.
Because in this plan as well, there were three different Mustangs, two white and one pale yellow.
Mm-hmm.
The two Mustangs, James Earl Ray's Mustang, the pale yellow, was parked outside the rooming house, orders by Raul. Then Raul had his own white Mustang 66 parked right behind it. This was quite an unusual muscle car in those days. So there's more than one witness that I have referred to these two Mustangs. And then a third, more or less identical white Mustang was parked just 100 meters down the street for the police and Raul as a decoy to take a, you know, to just confuse the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea was that James Earl Ray would be shot right outside Jim's Grill. Raul would run out with this bundle of stuff that was used as evidence against him, a rifle, a radio from his prison cell that is, you know, like with a serial number, everything, some bobby pins, some beer cans with James Earl Ray's fingerprints, some clothes that didn't fit him, but all of it just there to nail him as the patsy. And the idea was for Raul right when the shots were fired, just to come drop it in the car, in the back of the car, so that James Earl Ray would be dead on the pavement, all the evidence would be in the car, and case closed. Mm-hmm. But suddenly James Earl Ray got scared and took off. So when the shots were finally fired, because Jim Green was confused, waiting up on the roof, just not knowing, you know, just hope for, waiting for James Earl Ray to come back. So he was up there. Then he heard a shot, boom, on the back of the rooming house. Not, he had no idea about King being there or that part of the operation, which is also standard procedure with compartmentalization, you know, and just a need to know chain in these operations. So he's up there waiting. Then after the shots is fired, Raoul and Butch Collier comes running down the stairs, and Raoul is like, where the hell is the car? The car is gone. So he just drops the bundle on the pavement outside the Canopy amusement entrance and just jumps into the car together with Butch Collier. They take off, then turn around, come back, and Butch drops Raoul by the third Ford Mustang. He then takes off. Butch Collier comes back, honk the horn, and Jim Green jumps down the building, and they take off, not knowing that King has been killed. But Butch keeps repeating, I killed the nigger, I killed the nigger, the whole thing. So I believe he was the shooter in the rooming house.
Okay.
Not down in the bushes, that was Frank Strausser, and not one of the two sniper teams as well.
Okay.
This is what I believe happened. And then the following day, there was a meeting, an emergency meeting, where Raoul called them together and said that we are in deep shit here. You need to track down James Earl Ray and kill him. So they started a whole long hunt. You know, they followed him to, I think they followed him all the way to Montreal and almost got him killed there, but they failed and he managed to get away. But Raoul said that Rochi will kill us if we don't get him. Yeah. And this Rochi was actually a man called Cartha Deloach. And Cartha Deloach was number three in the FBI, behind Hoover and Tolson.
Okay.
So all three top people in the FBI were directly involved in this whole thing. But it doesn't end there. Because
yeah.
When there was an FBI guy who was, his name was Don Wilson, he was sent to check out this pale white Mustang that was just abandoned in Atlanta with Alabama plates. And when Wilson opened the car door, there were some papers that fell out. And for some reason, he just stuffed them in his pocket, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Later, when he examined them, he found a torn out piece of a Texas telephone directory from Dallas, and written on the page there was the name Raoul and then the initial J and a phone number. This phone number turned out to be a nightclub run by Jack Ruby.
What?
Jack Ruby. And Raoul, when James Earl Ray's attorney, Dr. William Pepper, went to Dallas with a picture of who they identified to be this Raoul, he was confirmed, his identity was confirmed by Beverly Oliver and two other women who worked for Jack Ruby as one of Jack Ruby's guests at the Carousel Club in Dallas.
Wow. Hola, that's incredible.
So we have direct connections with the JFK assassination again.
Again, more doubling up.
For sure, James Earl Ray had nothing to do with it. But when James Earl Ray was accused of all of this, his first lawyer, Arthur Haynes, he got hold of a private detective called Renfro Hayes. And this private eye managed to locate this man, Raoul, because when James Earl Ray was on the way from LA towards Memphis, he had made a phone call in Texas to him, but the payphone there was broke, so instead he used a private phone. So this private detective managed to get hold of the phone bill for that phone and got the number. So he called it and asked for Raul. It turned out that this phone number was to the Louisiana State Police.
Oh, you're kidding.
And, no. This man was, he was in his early 60s, small, dark complexion, ice-cold blue-gray eyes, salt and pepper hair, wavy hair. And his name was, as far as I know, Raul Escobade. This private detective, Renfro, he met Raul in a restaurant. They were, I mean, like he said, they were both aware what it was all about. But this private eye, he understood that, you know, if he kept sniffing around, he would end up dead. So he backed away. But I'm just going to identify the different Raul personalities, as far as I know.
Yep.
This man was called, as far as I know, Raul Escobade. Okay, then in Montreal, the Raul in Montreal was a man specializing in false identities, working for the CIA and MOB. And his name was Raul Miori, possibly Raul Coelho, or Raul Miori Coelho. In Montreal, James Earl Ray was given four different identities. He said he just picked them out of the phone book, but all four of them were more or less the same age as him. They were similar in appearance. And 1 month before the assassination, James Earl Ray even had plastic surgery, adding a scar to the top, the tip of his nose, making a very similar scar as the man whose identity he was using at the time of the assassination, Eric S. Gault. And these four different people in Montreal, whose identity he was using, all lived within a square mile of the same, suburb of Montreal. So I believe absolutely not a coincidence, and maybe these four identities were being prepared as possible patsies, and the only reason we don't know about them is because James Earl Ray was the one that took the four. Maybe one of the other ones were aimed for Miami, another one for Los Angeles,
yeah,
and so on.
Yeah.
And so had it not been James Earl Ray, then one of the other ones would have been the one.
Yeah.
That was more or less it.
What transpired after the court case that the King family put up, the civil court case?
Nothing. Most people have never, ever heard of this court case. And, like when O.J. Simpson, when that trial was going on, the media was camping outside the courthouse for like 2.5 months.
Mm-hmm.
And then when this happened, which should be the trial of the century, in my opinion, in total, there was one journalist that was there every day. The rest of the days, there were a few here, a few there, and so on. And every time any critical evidence was being presented, the press was asked to leave the courtroom.
Oh, really?
Huh. Yeah.
Yeah, the just us system.
What can I say? That's the way it is, and it keeps repeating.
And what year was that trial?
December 1999.
Okay.
Many of the people who are involved in these things, they die very violently, like Sam Giancana, Rosselli was found chopped up in a barrel in Hudson Bay. And I believe that J. Edgar Hoover was killed as well. Officially, he died from a heart attack in 1972 in the bathroom in his home. But what happens with these things is that they get buried so fast, there's no autopsy, everything is a jump, 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 boom, and gone. And this is exactly what happened here as well.
Oh, right. Okay.
So he did not have a problem with his heart before this. Like they say, I quote, remains were given accelerated treatment, whatever that means. Meaning that he got embalmed very, very quickly and then buried in a Freemasonic temple.
What?
In a lead-lined coffin in the Congressional Cemetery You know, so also with lead-lined coffin, you can't X-ray, you can't sort of get access to that.
Yeah.
So I would suggest maybe something in the bathroom is toothpaste or, you know, something like that was poisoned and,
okay.
and caused for an...
But he would have been a holder of many truths.
Ooh.
So many.
That was the power of J. Edgar Hoover was the secrets of everyone. That was what he used the FBI for, was to gather evidence against people so that he could blackmail them.
Maybe they were after his black book.
Well, he was feared, I tell you.
God, rightly so.
Yeah.
Those photos that you sent me, there's that amazing photo of Hoover with his dog, with his bulldog.
Mm.
And I can't help sort of looking at the bulldog and thinking, wow, that's a beautiful animal there on the left.
I tell you, I'm going to end with one thing because there's a judge called Joe Brown who was involved in the court case and so on. And he claims that he even knows what one of the rifles was, what type of rifle and so on. And the one he talks about is from the sniper team inside the fire station.
Right.
He says that they were in the cafeteria connected to the dormitory and they were using a cafeteria table as a stand. They had opened the windows, so they were inside the room and shot from inside the room. So the barrel wasn't even outside and so on.
Mm-hmm.
But he says it was a converted M14. It was an XM21, specially made, one of 63 sniper rifles manufactured of this model. It was a NATO caliber 7.62. with a special stainless steel barrel, a Redfield 3x9 telescopic sight modified by a company called Leatherwood. It was using a special subsonic ammunition with a suppressor to reduce the velocity of the bullet to below subsonic, and this was made to confuse the sound signal below 1,100 feet per second.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you do that, especially if you're in an area with lots of buildings, you know, when a bullet passes, you would hear the echo because there's a building, there's empty space, mm-hmm. there's a building. So the ear can track from where the shots are fired.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
when it comes too low, too slow in speed, that doesn't occur.
Okay.
And
wow.
this rifle was in the inventory of the FBI, charming, in late 1967 as one of five rifles. And in later, after the assassination, there was only four rifles because they were supposed to be shipped to Vietnam, to sniper teams in Vietnam. And then one of the five said that it was either destroyed or missing and never found again.
My goodness.
But I would strongly suggest that that was one of the sniper rifles.
One of the weapons. And... James Earl Ray's rifle, that wasn't even sighted correctly, was it?
No, it was a crap rifle. It was a Game Master, absolutely not used in the assassination.
Mm-hmm.
They even made, do you know, it was Raoul who ordered him to go to Birmingham and buy this rifle. And he made sure that the people in the shop would remember him because he came back with the wrong rifle, so he had to go back a second time and get it so that the people in the shop would for sure remember him.
Yeah.
Then, but the rifle that was used from the bushes by Frank Strausser, this man is still alive in Memphis.
He was the policeman, is that right?
Yeah, he's a police officer that together with Lieutenant Earl Clark were hiding in the bushes and was firing the shots from there. He was, like most people, after these assassinations, they become like untouchables. They will not be sentenced for anything. They can do whatever they want. And it's almost like they based the character Dirty Harry on him. I tell you, this guy was just out of control.
Wow.
When they fired from the bushes, Frank Strauss threw the rifle as far, this is the way I understand, he threw the rifle, he had been practicing the whole day before the assassination and the whole day when it happened at the shooting range, and this is how he was identified by one of the people working there. He was using a very special rifle, and he threw that rifle right after the shots were fired to Earl Clark. Earl Clark then ran to the back of the of Jim's Grill, where the owner, Lloyd Jowers, was waiting for the rifle. He threw the rifle to him, and then he took off. Strauss went up and passed the whole thing, got into a green Chevy. That Chevy took off right before a police car came and blocked the street, so that the police let him out, then blocked the street.
Mm-hmm.
And Earl Clark jumped down. There was like a wall down to the street. When the shots were fired, a lot of people came out from the fire station, and he sort of disappeared in the crowd. But there was one witness that saw him jump down the wall. And then he ran up Mulberry Street and jumped into a police car, and the police car then took off. So within seconds, the shooters were out, away, you know, gone.
Mm-hmm.
But the witness that saw that called the police and said, I saw the shooter, but I think you already got him because they took him in a police car and they took off. But that was the escape car.
That is an incredible story, and just the linkage of it, connections with Kennedy and with both Kennedys, quite amazing, quite amazing, and just think that some of these people are still alive.
Yeah, and if not them, then their kids or relationship. You know, it's the whole power structure that mm-hmm. took these people are still in place. The whole death machine that is carrying out this war on terror and the chemtrailing us and whatever. It's the same small little group of people. So this is why we need to expose these things.
Yeah. Bring it to a stop. I'm getting rather sick and tired of my brothers and sisters being wiped out.
Yeah. Yeah, because these are beautiful people. It's so many amazing souls that have been taken out, you know, because of just because they've been standing up for what is true and right.
Mm-hmm. It's been happening for a very long time.
I just want to mention that this year has been quite amazing to me. I was awarded the Prague Peace Prize in the Czech Republic earlier this year. And in November, I've been invited as one of the key speakers at the JFK Assassination Conference in Dallas, which is absolutely amazing.
Hola, congratulations.
Thank you so much. A bit scary, I must say. I am not comfortable going to the U.S. at the moment, especially not lately after I've been doing these interviews about Jesse Jackson and so on. But
and especially your favorite city.
So wish me luck. Yeah.
I will. And congratulations also for the Prague Peace Prize. I was going to be congratulating you at the beginning of the interview, but due to the different problems we've had, it slipped my mind.
Yeah, we've been disconnected. Is it three times during this interview?
So, yeah, but we've bounced back.
We bounced back. That's the idea.
Hey, Ola, it's wonderful to receive this information and to speak to you once again. LightOnConspiracies.com is the website where you can find more information from Ola. Do you have any books that are coming out at all, Ola, or any other material?
Yeah, I've got several books on Amazon. I've got Coup d'etat in slow motion about the assassination of the Swedish Prime Minister Olof Palme, but with all the connections going even into the JFK assassination. And I've got Shadow of Tears. It's another book. It's a true story about how I took a bicycle. I was on my way to South Africa from Sweden, and instead I took this old bicycle, and we ended up in Iran instead, in the middle of the war in the 1980s. And I thought this was a country filled with crazy Iranian mad people running around screaming Allah Akbar, shooting each other. But instead I met the most beautiful, kind, generous people I've ever met in a very, very difficult situation.
Yeah, it's amazing that you should say that, because the people that I've met that have been to Iran, they have all said exactly the same thing.
Yeah. Then one of the people I got to know there got murdered, and his brother and best friend was very scared because they thought they were going to be the next on the line. So I risked everything, and I smuggled one of them out via Moscow, East Germany, and up to Sweden, where we managed to, he was supposed to be deported, but we managed to stop that as well. He got asylum. He's now a doctor, a heart specialist. And in the end, we got seven more people, or seven in total, out of Iran to Sweden.
Okay.
And the book is a true story, lots of photos and so on. Then I got one book called Remind Me. It's a small little power book. It's a one-hour read, but it's about how to control your mind, how to become fearless, and how to... so it's called Remind Me, how to reset your mind. And then I got a yoga, a kid's book called Yolanda Yoga Panda.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
based great.
On, yeah, I'm an international Raja Yoga teacher. And then... Mm-hmm. I've got several new books coming out, one called The Global Tour of Terror, about all these false flag crap operations that have been going on for the last few years, how they're all connected, and another one called The Elusive Enigma, about the real truth, as far as I see it, about the assassination of Olof Palme. But I'm also in the process of working on a series of books with Professor Jim Fetzer. It's a series of books. It's on moon rock books. The first book is about the fake moon landing, the fake Paul McCartney, the fake Bin Laden, fake Saddam Hussein. About these things, showing this is not just, you know, like the work of one person, but in these books are like every time 12 to 15. Highly respected researchers, you know, PhDs and professors and you name it, journalists, authors. And the second book is about Sandy Hook. The first one is mm-hmm. called And I Suppose We Didn't Go to the Moon Either. The second book is called Nobody Died at Sandy Hook, which nobody did. It's 470 pages about showing absolute proof that there nobody died at all. Totally staged fake event. That mm-hmm. book got banned on Amazon. Amazon
oh,
stopped.
Really?
It. Yeah. So then we started, we let it out for free as an ebook. You can download it on my website, lightandconspiracies.com. Mm-hmm. And then we found another publisher that was willing to do it. So we made a second, more updated version. So there's three. One, the original, where the cover, after it was banned, it got like the stamp banned by Amazon. And then the final one, where it's more updated. Then a third book is called And Nobody Died in Boston Either. Boston bombing, absolute fake event. Once again, 400 and some pages, just showing it step by step by step by step. Absolutely not true. Mm-hmm. Then the fourth book is American Nuked on 9/11. It's about 9/11 and mm-hmm. just taking that whole thing apart. Now I'm in the finishing process of doing one about Orlando and
okay.
all of the things happening this month. Orlando, Dallas, now with Hillary's, you know, her using doubles and all this kind of crap. And then... soon there will be two JFK books as well. We're aiming at getting at least one out before the 22nd of November, the anniversary of when he was killed. And then a second one about the JFK follow-up there. So,
okay.
Busy, busy, busy.
You've been very busy, Ola. Well done. It's good when someone can be productive.
Thank you.
And still retain their honor.
Well, that means a lot to me. But can I add, I'm a one-man band and not funded by anyone, not part of an organization, nothing. So if anyone would like to support me in exposing these things, please, there are donation buttons on my website. There are sign up for my newsletter, membership on my website. That is the only income I have from these type of things. And even though it sounds really fancy and glitter and glamour to go to conferences, I tell you, most of the time, I don't get paid at all. I don't get paid for interviews. I don't get paid for articles. And in Dallas, I get the 2 nights in a hotel. Somebody has donated the plane ticket, and I get $100. So not a lot. So I'm trying to raise money to be able to stay there for a week so that I can spend time on Dealey Plaza after all of these years. And really, this is the JFK is the one I focused most on over the years. And for me to finally be able to go there is going to be amazing.
Yeah, so I can imagine.
You're going to see me crawl around on all fours on the grassy knoll and looking down pipelines and, you know, like counting trees and branches and things on the picket fence.
Oh, that is wonderful, Ola. And I will make sure that I'll include your link to your website as well as any other links you want me to highlight for you as well. From me here on the volcano, I'd like to send you thoughts and energy and wish you all the best with your endeavors, and may you continue to be productive and in a wonderfully honorable way that you are.
Thank you so much. And just one thing, the way forward, nonviolence, compassion, fearless exposure, let the truth do the work. If you use violence, you will sabotage the whole thing. Violence is their language, and they're just trying, they're poking us from all different directions, saying, go, 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 trying to provoke us. Not the way to do it. So that's my last words. And if it's okay with you, I would like to finish with a prayer.
Please.
May the entire universe be filled with peace and joy, love and light. May everyone, and especially the ones who heard us, be filled with peace and joy, love and light. Victory to that light.
Yeah. Ola Demigod, thank you very much.
We did it, Max.
We did it. Hallelujah.